Today's Taisho is on case 44 in the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 44 is entitled Ka-san's Beating the Drum. Main subject. Ka-san said, learning by study is called hearing. Learning no more is called nearness. Transcending these two is true passing. A monk asked, what is true passing? Ka-san said, beating the drum. The monk asked again, what is the true teaching of the Buddha? Ka-san said, beating the drum. The monk asked once more, I would not ask you about this very mind is Buddha, but what is no mind, no Buddha? Ka-san said, beating the drum. The monk still continued to ask, when an enlightened one comes, how do you treat him? Ka-san said, beating the drum. Secho's verse, dragging a stone, carrying earth, use the spiritual power of a 1,000-ton bow. Zokutsu Roshi rolled out 3 wooden balls. How could they surpass Ka-san's beating the drum? I will tell you, what is sweet is sweet. What is bitter is bitter. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. Some people, about 8 people here, came right at the beginning of the morning. So those people arrived at 7 o'clock, or one person arrived at 8. We recited sutras together, and that's an hour almost of meditation. So then we did 3 periods of meditation, and then we did 2 more periods of meditation. And if you go through that whole process, one of the things that happens is that your mind begins to get very, very deep. So if you meditate for, say, 20 minutes on any particular day, that's certainly very valuable. And you may feel that your mind is in a very deep place, but if you come here on a Saturday, let's say, or if you go to Sesshin, and you meditate for a number of hours, you'll realize how much deeper your concentration can be. It's typically the case that people come in to sit, and especially in the evening, when people meditate in the evening, at the end of the sitting period, I'll ask a person, how was your sit? And they'll just say, well, it was okay, my mind was so full of thoughts, right? As we go through the day, we have all of these events that pull at us, they grip at us. And by the time we get home, it's difficult to put them down, and that can be very wearing, right? Like everybody else, I have a job. I have challenges in my job. I have a boss who will tell me to do something, and then I'll do it, and then the boss will say, well, actually, I want you to do the opposite, right? So then you have to undo everything you did, and that happens to me, too. And it can be, do the opposite of what I told you to do. I've changed my mind, and by the way, you have like 2 days to do it. So, when you are in a situation like that, you go home, perhaps, and you might think about it. It might affect your evening. It's very difficult to put it down. And so if you come to sit that evening, after 2 periods of meditation, your mind might be a little bit clearer, but it might not. It might just be very busy, lots of stuff going on in your mind. And so, coming on a Saturday is really valuable because you know, let's say you arrived here at 8 o'clock and there was a lot buzzing around in your mind. You know, when you started sitting, all of that probably came to the surface. It's really excellent to sit in the morning, right? Morning sitting is the best sitting, especially, you know, actually just before the sun comes up. But just as the sun comes up is a good second best. When you rise out of sleep, you're in a different mental state than you are at the end of the day. You know, your mind has processed a lot while you were asleep, and you're in a clearer place generally. This is why people who do Zen get up early in the morning, because the mind is in such a wonderful state for deep sitting. And it's why at our sesshins, you know, our early morning sit, the first three sits of the day, are for many people the best sits. So, you know, if you came here this morning and you sat down on the cushion and you started watching your breath, you may have found that events of the day came back to you, right? Even though your sleeping process has cleared away a lot of that stuff, you still might have found that as you're sitting, the things that bothered you yesterday bother you this morning too. But, you know, as you keep coming back to your breath, and as the sits, one sit is added to the next sit, you know, you notice that these things become less gripping. You know, if you're one of these people who has a tendency to obsess about details, where you review them over and over again in your head, you know, this is really liberating, right? You know, you might come in to sit and have a lot bothering you. And, you know, after three sits in a row, you know, probably the most important thing you're struggling with might be pain in your leg, not the problems that are bothering you. And actually, that's a much superior situation. Because, you know, you're just bringing your mind right back to the present moment, which is where it should be. And even if you're thinking, my knee hurts or something like that, you're in a much better state than you are when you're lost in your thoughts and you're obsessing, right? So, and in fact, having a little discomfort is even very focusing, right? It's definitely the case that if you're slightly uncomfortable on the cushion and you're focusing your attention very carefully on the breath, you know, your pain will recede. And you will get into deep concentration, and your mind will become clear as a bell. You know, this is definitely the case. You know, in that situation where you've done one sit, two sit, three sits, let's say, and, you know, your knee begins to hurt at the end of the second sit, and during the third sit it comes back, and you're sweeping that pain away with your breath, you'll notice that your mind empties out. Right, all of those thoughts that were obsessing you are gone, and you're when the bell rings and you get off the cushion and you walk down the hallway to the bathroom, you know, it's like all the thoughts have been blown out of your head, you know, and it's just like the clear sky, you know. That's so liberating. That's so beautiful. Being able to get to that place takes a lot of sitting. You know, being able to get to that clear, that blue sky mind where things that were bothering you are gone, and it's just like the mind, it's just like wind blowing across a few stray clouds across the sky. After three sits, your mind can be like that, and it can be glorious. You know, one of the wonderful things about Zen practice is that, you know, you can cope with almost anything if you have cultivated this kind of concentration. You know, serious crises usually send a lot of people into a tailspin. If you can sit down on the cushion and sit for an hour and a half and collect your awareness, focus your mind on your breath, and then work through all of this stuff that's bothering you, you get to that clear blue sky mind, it's like you can handle anything. And when it happens quite regularly, if you practice, it's so liberating. You realize that these things which bothered you are not worth hanging on to. And there's a kind of freedom that comes from being able to get into that blue sky mind state. It's like everything's been wiped away and you can just engage with the present moment. So this is definitely liberating. And it requires a fair amount of practice. If you sit once a day for, say, 15 or 20 minutes, probably you're not getting to that place. So, you know, the truth is that it takes about 15 minutes just to quiet the mind. So, I will meet people who say, I meditate 15 minutes a day, and they actually aren't meditating yet, you know. So if you give yourself 15 minutes during a day, what you're doing is you're beginning to quiet the mind. And in around, if you're practiced, after about 15 minutes, you have a deep relaxation response. So you do feel your tension begin to dissipate. But if you stay on the cushion longer than, say, around 20 or 25 minutes, you will feel a little better, but you may notice that the things you were not paying attention to, the things that bothered you, have come back. They come back. Because you're now getting beyond just calming the mind, and you're sort of, you could say, reaching into the deeper part of your mind. I'll never forget overhearing a conversation between two people who were, one person had been practicing for about a year, and the other person had just come to sit. And the person who had just started coming to sit said, oh, this is so wonderful. You know, when I sit down on the cushion, my mind becomes so clear. And the other person who stopped coming to sit said ruefully, well, it's like that at first, but then your thoughts, you know, the thoughts that bother you come back. And that's definitely true. You know, you have to work through those thoughts. So, you know, if you sit down on the cushion, after 15 minutes you begin to feel better, your mind is just beginning to calm down, and you have a deep relaxation response, which feels great. But then you may find that, you know, the things that you wanted to avoid confronting are there, and you have to sit with them for a while, maybe one sit, two sits, three sits. And as you're sitting with these things that bother you, you know, you're working with your breath, so something arises that bothers you, and you breathe out, and then it bothers you again, and it's triggering these emotional responses. But if you just stay there, motionless, on the cushion, you begin to notice that they stop triggering these emotions. So, you know, what happened to me this week was that my boss said, everything I asked you to do, I want you to stop doing, and I want you to do the very opposite, and you have 2 days to get it all worked out. So, you know, if you sit down on the cushion, you have a relaxation response, you feel great, but you haven't really dealt with anything yet. And if you stay on the cushion, let's say, for another 15 minutes, and then you get up and you sit down and do another sit, this stuff begins to come up, and you can hear the dean's voice, or you can imagine your boss, you can reread the email that your boss sent you in your mind, you know. And it triggers responses. Like one response might be anger, right? Why tell me this at the 11th hour when it's so late, right? Why did you change your mind? You're not explaining this to me. You know, so you might feel frustrated, helpless, angry, worried about whether this can be done, right? All of the above. And you sit there with that, and you begin to calm down, and then you begin, these things come up, and they trigger an emotional response, and then they come up, and they trigger an emotional response, but you keep breathing through them. And after about two sits, you know, what you'll notice is they stop triggering an emotional response. So you can still, if you want to, you can still see the email from your boss in your mind, or you can still see your boss's face in your mind, but it's no longer triggering emotions like anger or anxiety, right? You just see their faces. And after a while, you stop seeing their faces. And your mind begins to empty out. You know, there's usually this process of working through the things that are triggering these powerful emotional responses. And then your mind begins to empty out. It begins to become clear and unobstructed. And it, you may not be able to get to that place in a single session of sitting, in two or three sits. You might be so rattled or so upset that, you know, you don't get to this serene place. But if you stay on the cushion and you're watching the breath, you're following the breath as these triggering thoughts arise, you know, they stop triggering emotions. And they just become things that happened. And after a while, they just vanish. And you get into a state where, you know, you have these ambient thoughts that come and go, but your mind is basically empty and clear. And if you practice a lot, you get there all the time. That's sort of like your baseline state. If you don't practice very much, it's very hard to get to that place. But, you know, many people might think that that's the state, that's like it. That's it, right? That's what I want to achieve. And if you achieve that, you know, it can take many years just to get to that place. If you achieve that, it's wonderful. Your life is fundamentally different because you realize that no matter what happens to you, you can work through it. You know, and some terrible things happen to people, right? You know, I'm old enough so that, you know, many of the people in my family are no longer here. And you know, having to, you know, deal with those events was very painful and difficult. And, you know, being able to sit down on the cushion and work my way through these events, which are very painful and difficult, and, you know, enter a place of brightness and clarity, that blue sky mind, so precious, right? And if people around you are falling apart and you can get into that place, you can be so helpful to other people who are not able to get into that place. And that's really like the bodhisattva's job, is to be able to get to that place and then be able to assist those who are still trapped by their mental habits and by their these very heavy emotional charges that some events carry, right? People become paralyzed by sadness or paralyzed by anxiety. And if you can get to that blue sky mind, you can assist all these people. You can help them work through their sorrow without feeling afraid yourself, and so on. So it's possible to think of that as like it. That's it. That's where we want to be. But actually, you know, there's always something more to encounter in life, right? So, you know, actually, we tend to think that that people who, say, live in monasteries have an advantage over people who don't live in monasteries. And there is a truth to that, right? I mean, if you have a regular 9-to-5 and you have a family and so on, it's very difficult to find time to meditate, right? It's just hard. You know, so you have to get up. There used to be a member in our group who was a postman. And when he first came here to sit, he came here we used to have a little beginner's night. And he and his wife came, and they could only sit for 10 minutes. It was like 10 minutes they had it. And I thought, well, these people will never come back, but they came back a week later, and we did 15 minutes, and pretty soon we were up to half an hour. He got really into this practice. And he began to sort of like escalate his practice by sitting more on his own. And he's a postman, so he has to get to work really early, but he would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning just so he could sit for an hour before he would jump in the shower, wash his face, and run off to work, which I think is incredibly admirable and unusual, you know, but this guy really did it. And he did it for years and years and became an absolutely expert practitioner of Zen, really very advanced practitioner. He retired and moved to California. But, you know, it's most people don't have that self-discipline or that drive. It's very difficult for people to do that. Whereas if you're in a monastery, you know, everybody gets up at 3:30, everybody has to meditate, you know, so it makes it easy. You know, you have to meditate. You have to. And you get up at 3:30 just to make sure you don't miss anything, right? So, you know, basically a schedule in, say, a Japanese or Chinese monastery would be getting up at 3:30. You know, basically, sometimes they're sitting first and then later sutras. Sometimes there's sutras and then sitting. Then there's breakfast. And it's a long day of sitting, like Sesshin sometime, with some work in between, unlike Sesshin. So you have sort of a built-in advantage. You have to get on the cushion, which is so hard for so many people. But you know, actually, after a certain point, it's not necessarily an advantage to be in a monastery. Because, you know, if you go to a monastery and you get the drill down and you like it, it's like that until you die, right, pretty much. So you know, it's definitely the case that, you know, monasteries in East Asia are full of people, men and women, who really love that life. But there's not much variation, right? You know, you're pretty much getting up at 3:30 for the rest of your life, and you're going to bed at like 9:30 or something. And it's one of the good things about not living in a monastery is that there's so much that can bug us. Right, so much that can bother us that is unexpected or challenging. Right, we don't have so much control over our environment. You know, so when things because of that, you know, it's actually a wonderful opportunity to deepen our practice. So you know. Once you can get into blue sky mind, that's a real achievement. But what you really need to find is something that actually doesn't allow you to get into blue sky mind easily. And if you're in a monastery, I would say that's actually rather difficult to do. But, you know, one of the things about not being in a monastery is that life hands us all of these, like, real-life koans. Right, real life koans. So, you know, my sister-in-law has gone through a divorce, and she now has two children. And in the divorce settlement, she and her husband split the house. And this is a house my sister-in-law has worked on for almost 20 years. She is an artist, but she's believe it or not, she's a very talented woodworker and carpenter. And she's done all of this amazing work on this house. You know, she knocked out a bunch of walls, and she bought a bunch of French doors and put them in as windows. They don't really open, but it's like two walls of windows. It's a 45-degree angle, so you come in through the door, and then you're in this beautiful sunny room with all of these windows all along the wall. And you know, if you didn't know how she did it, you would just think it's a room full of windows. But she just bought a bunch of French doors that were on sale and made this beautiful wall. And you know, there's a portico around the building that she built, and she poured the footings herself, and she made the pillars herself, and she made the, you know, she's put all of this effort and love and attention into her house. And we were staying with her, and, you know, she remodeled her bathroom, and she put brick floors in, and Some of the bricks are, most of the bricks are red, but there's a few like enamel blue bricks. You know, they're just, it's like a little touch of beauty. Somebody cared about those floors. You know, her name is Chris. Chris really did a beautiful job with the bathroom. So the thing is, you know, her kids are in college now, and one of them's out of college, graduated, and is working, and the other's in college, and neither of them live at home, and now that she's gotten her divorce, she can't really make the house payments herself. Right. So she does, the house might not really be big enough to rent, so she wants to turn the garage into a rental. Well, all of this is the kind of thing that keeps people up at night. Right, it keeps people up at night, and it eats away at you because, you know, she has a pension plan that she can draw on, but her resources are limited, and she doesn't want to lose this house that she put all her sweat equity in. And she was, she was in a lot of emotional distress, and she doesn't regularly meditate. But we had a chance to meditate together when I was in Albuquerque, and you know, she said, you know, this really, she doesn't have a lot of self-discipline sometimes, and it's difficult for her to sit down on a cushion and just do nothing. But when you sit with somebody else, sometimes it's easier. So when we sat together, she actually did it. You know, I was kind of surprised. We've done it before. But this time we were doing it very regularly, and she said it's, you know, really cutting my anxiety down. So, you know, this kind of situation, I'm sorry my sister-in-law hasn't done more meditation. But, you know, this is the kind of situation that helps us to deepen our practice. You know, without something like this, it's very difficult to know where we are in our practice, right? You know, if you can get into Blue Sky Mind fairly easily and you're living a fairly routine life, your life is pretty predictable, your sources of stress are fairly controllable, it's hard to grow under circumstances like that. You know, and nobody wants to be lying awake at night wondering if they're going to lose their house. But, you know, those kinds of events give us the chance to become more awake. You know, my sister-in-law isn't a practitioner, so it would be hard for her to turn this into an opportunity to wake up more deeply. But she could if she started sitting a lot. You know, if she really started sitting, this could transform her. You know, if it's a sunny day and it's peaceful and you're on vacation and you're looking out at a beautiful valley and you sit down and do some meditation, that's just wonderful. But not much can really be gained from that situation. You know, the situations that really produce deeper insight are the ones where we're not comfortable, we're not at ease, we're not happy. And we have to work through our obstacles. And maybe we haven't even confronted our obstacles or know what they are. So, you know, basically, this situation my sister-in-law is struggling with is a horrible situation, but it could be for her the opportunity to deepen her practice. You know, I don't think she will, but I wish she would do a lot of meditation. I wish she would get up every day while she's struggling with this and sit for like two periods of meditation. And, you know, she would get to a place, if she just did that, where she had such clarity and stability and her fear would go away. And if she were in that state, she would probably make better decisions. And this is going to sound rather insensitive, but you know, people do lose their houses. And losing your house is nothing anybody wants to have happen to them, right? But on the other hand, even something like losing your house can be an opportunity to become a more liberated person, a more deeply awake person with fewer attachments and obstacles. So, you know, actually, it's a very good thing sometimes that we're, if we practice Zen, if we really make Zen part of our lives and we do regular meditation practice, life is usually serving us up challenges that we might not have if we were in a protected environment. You know, generally speaking, monks and nuns don't have to worry about losing their house, right? I mean, they don't really have a house, but they have a monastery where my first teacher studied was called Daitokuji, which has been around for about 1,200 years. Or, you know, so not going out of business tomorrow. My sister-in-law could lose her house next year. And so, you know, this kind of environment, which is punishing and frightening sometimes, actually is a wonderful opportunity to wake up. People don't necessarily understand this about Zen or about Buddhism in general, because they think that the purpose of meditation is to be still and calm. You know, still and calm. But, you know, the purpose of meditation is to be still and calm in the midst of, you know, what is not still and calm, if that makes any sense. You know, I was on Facebook. I was on Facebook the other day, and a person I know who's a Facebook friend, I've never met him, but he's very interested in Zen, and he had a film clip from the BBC. And it was about Shaolin, the training of Shaolin monks. And it was focusing on this one Shaolin monk who had been training for like 10 years. And he was doing his, like his doctoral examination in Wushu, in his martial art. And he was training to do this one particular, it showed him training with his shifu, his teacher. And the teacher was trying to get him to do this one, I don't know what the Chinese word for it is, but in Japanese they're called kata. They're sequences of movements that you do to create a complete action. Right, so there's like these standard sequences of movements you do, and there's different steps, and each one has to be executed, like in figure skating. Each one has to be executed as well as you possibly can, right? And part of the routine this monk had to go through involved working with a staff, which he, you know, was using as a weapon. And then at one point he was supposed to take the staff and make it upright so that he's holding the top of the staff and the bottom of the staff is touching the ground. And he's supposed to lean the staff at a 30-degree angle, and then he's supposed to basically step with both feet on the staff and basically hold that position for a few seconds. And then jump off the staff, right, and not drop it, and, you know, sweep it up with his hand. So very complicated, right? He's going through this complicated series of motions, and the culmination is leaning the staff over, standing with both feet on the staff. The staff is supposed to just freeze in the air for a few minutes, it feels like minutes, but it's really seconds. And then he's supposed to leap off the staff and come down. And they said what he's demonstrating is stillness in motion. Stillness in motion. See? That even in the midst of motion, there's a stillness which is imperturbable. See? And he kept practicing and practicing and kept failing, right? And his teacher said, just like in Zen, he said, you know, you're trying too hard. You're trying too hard. You know, trust your true nature. Trust your true nature. You know, you're trying too hard and it's not natural. Uwei, uwei. So, you know, the guy's been practicing for 10 years and he has the He has the skill. It's just he's putting too much pressure on himself. So anyway, it showed his doing his final routine for his for the abbot of the temple, who gives the certification at the end. And he did that amazing routine flawlessly, right? Leans the staff over, jumps on the staff with both feet. So he's really just holding the staff with his left hand. Both feet are on the staff. It freezes in the air. Then he leaps off and sweeps the staff with his hand. You know, and he, of course, passed the exam. So you know, I think that it's possible to say, what is wushu? What does martial arts have to do with Zen anyway? Isn't Zen about sitting on a cushion in stillness? And those monks do sit on a cushion in stillness. But, you know, if you're making a distinction between stillness and movement, you're still in samsara. You know, that's a small mind way of thinking. You're always in stillness, whether you're moving or not. You know, you're always in stillness, whether you're moving or not. It's easy to be in stillness when you sit down on the cushion and it's a summer day and you've just gotten a raise and you've gotten plenty of sleep and you're in good health, etc. It's harder to be in stillness if you're losing your house. But when you're losing your house, there's still a stillness, this indestructible, imperturbable stillness there that you can find if you practice, right? If you practice. And if you find it, you can handle anything, including the loss of your house or saving your house or whatever outcome there is. See? So, you know, we distinguish between stillness and motion. You know, there's, and there is, for a beginner, it's definitely the case. See, for beginners, you know, when your mind is swirling around in a obsessive circle, right? You're just obsessing. You know, you come in to sit, and you sit for two periods, and it's like, peace, stillness. You know, you stop going around and around in those loops, and you're in stasis. It's motionless. The mind becomes motionless, imperturbable. And it's like, oh, that's wonderful. But that's a very big, that takes maybe, you know, a number of years to be able to get to that place. But nevertheless, that's still a very elementary state of cultivation. Because, you know, it's easy to sit down on the cushion and enter stillness. Much harder to practice, Kung Fu or, Shaolin martial arts and be moving the whole time, but your mind is motionless. Your mind is motionless. See, so you know, that's part of the training. You know, actually, when you're working with an opponent, you know, I don't do martial arts, but I was reading that, you know, part of the goal is to maintain this stable mind through the whole process. So, you know, if somebody's coming at you, you don't focus on his hands. You keep your gaze open at the whole horizon, and you don't focus on the details. You maintain that imperturbable mind. That's the art of the Shaolin practice. So you know, basically, no matter how you're moving, you're still in that. You're nevertheless in that stillness. And that, you know, we don't have to practice martial arts. That's what Zen is really all about, is being able to maintain that stillness when, you know, your child is crying and the milk carton is tipped over and the milk is running off on the kitchen floor and the dog is, you know, has just punched through the screen door and, you know, the cat has pooped on the living room rug. That being able to find that stillness or maintain that stillness, that's such a wonderful opportunity. So basically, you know, Zen is not about stillness ultimately if you cling to stillness. You know, so many people do that. You know, they practice until they can get to a quiet state, a state of no motion. And they cling to that state. And actually, that creates many problems. You know, so when you're in your office and it's chaos, you think to yourself, oh, if only I were out of this office and I were on my cushion where I could have peace, see. So in a way, that actually makes the situation worse, doesn't it? I mean, knowing that you can get to a place that's quiet and calm is good. You know, if you didn't have that, you might become an alcoholic or something like that. So knowing I can get to my cushion, this is crazy right now, but I can get to my cushion and I can calm my mind and I can get to a state of moderate hysteria instead of total hysteria. That's great. But actually, you know, at a certain stage in your practice, if you cling to that stillness, you know, it actually creates an obstacle, right? Because you, when you're not in stillness, you wish you were. And the hard part of practice is learning how to be in that stillness wherever you are, whatever is going on, even if somebody's outside beating a drum, see? And so, you know, you're sitting on the cushion and you hear somebody beating the drum and you might think, that is terrible, they're interrupting my serene sit, see? Actually, that shows that you are both quite accomplished in your sitting and that you have a ways to go, right? The fact that you're able to get into deep samadhi is very takes a lot of work. That takes years of practice. But when you hear the drums outside and you want to recoil or you want to close it off because it's interrupting your calm, stable concentration, that's an intermediate response, right? That's somebody who's able to enter calm, stable concentration, which takes a number of years. But when you recoil from something like that, which is quite natural, and this is not a criticism, you have to be able to find the stillness in that, or maintain that stillness in the midst of that, right? And if you try to shut it out, if you try to close it off, you'll notice that you're getting tense and you're getting maybe even pissed off, right? So trying to block it out actually makes it more of an obstacle. So as usual, the proper thing is to become one with the object of your attention. So if the drums are beating outside and we're in here sitting, if you try to block out the drums, they become louder. It's like if you try to, you know, basically, you know, don't think of an elephant. All you're going to think of is an elephant. So if you say, I don't want to deal with that, those drums, you know, when there's a lull, you're going to say, oh, thank God there's a lull. And then there's the drumming. It's like, oh, the drumming again. But the other alternative path is to become one with the sound. And if you become one with the sound, you realize that it doesn't undermine your stability at all. It doesn't take away the stillness, that the stillness is in the sound. The stillness is in the sound. If you find the stillness in the sound, you become porous and unobstructed, right? And you're back into that wonderful relaxed state. Now, it's difficult to do this. This is a challenge, you know. You may have seen photos of monks meditating on a busy street corner in Bangkok or something like that. That's very difficult to do. You know, for people who are just beginner to intermediate, you know, noises are very annoying, especially early on when you're just starting to enter samadhi. You know, ambient noise, it just completely shatters your concentration. When I was just getting started, I started getting up every morning in graduate school and sitting in the morning. This was before I started sitting at the Seattle Zen Center with Genki Roshi. I was going once a week and sitting with Genki Roshi, but I decided to get up in the morning and sit. And my apartment was above an apartment occupied by two Iranian guys. And I think the first thing they did in the morning was turn on their TV. So I would get up at like, 5 o'clock or 5:30, and I would sit, and I'd have like a 20 minutes of real serene quiet, and then the TV would be on. And I would try to sit, and it would just drive me crazy. You know, it made me mad, I couldn't concentrate, you know, and finally, it's one of the reasons I started going to the Zen Center, because it was quiet. They didn't have a TV at the Zen Center, and that was a good thing. But so, you know, and if I were meditating at some other time of day and somebody was honking a horn or something, it would send me right up through the ceiling. You know, it would just make me completely pissed off. Like, how dare they honk their horn? I'm meditating, right? So that's a typical beginner's response, right? But you know, the challenge is to find that stillness wherever you are in any situation. That means that you're no longer clinging to stillness in your actions, because you are stillness, right? You are stillness. Kassan said, learning by study is called hearing. Learning no more is called nearness. Transcending these two. In other words, there's always something more to learn. You know, the Dharma, Weineng, when we recite the four great vows, Weineng's four great vows, he says, you know, basically, the Buddha's knowledge is infinite. We vow to learn it all. The Buddha's knowledge is infinite. You know, Shujo Muhan saying, the Buddha's knowledge is infinite. We vow to learn it all. If it's infinite, we'll never be done. Right, but of course, how wonderful that is. There's always something more to learn. Kassan said, learning by study is called hearing. Hearing no more is called nearness. Transcending these two is true passing. See, the stillness in motion. A monk asked, what is true passing? Kassan said, beating the drum. You act from that stillness. That stillness is imperturbable. You don't shatter the stillness when you act, see? Beating the drum. The monk doesn't get it. The monk asked again, what is the true teaching of the Buddha? Kassan said, beating the drum. The monk asked once more, I would not ask you about this very mind is Buddha, but what is no mind, no Buddha? Kassan said, beating the drum. The monk still continued to ask, when an enlightened one comes, how will you treat him? Kassan said, beating the drum. Dragging a stone, carrying earth, using the spiritual power of a 1,000-ton bow. See, stillness in action. Zokutsu Roshi rolled out 3 wooden balls. How could they surpass Kassan's beating the drum? I will tell you, what is sweet is sweet, what is bitter, bitter.